Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight we have a panel discussion presented by Boston University's Institute for Human Science and the American Council on Germany in cooperation with the Consul General of the Federal Republic of Germany. The discussion is entitled The Challenges of European Integration, Views from Old and New Europe. Our speakers tonight are Gesine Schwan, president of the European University Viadrina in Frankfurt, and Professor Michael Bukowski, a distinguished visiting professor for international affairs at Columbia University, where he is the first holder of the Polish Program Studies Chair. Introducing our panelists is Marie Warburg, director of the American Council on Germany. Ms. Warburg.
Good evening to all of you. I am Marie Warburg. I'm a director of the American Council on Germany, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to this panel discussion on the challenges of European integration. I will just say very few words about the American Council on Germany before introducing our honored speakers. The American Council on Germany was founded in 1952 by a small group of people who felt the need for reconciliation, felt the need for furthering, sponsoring, understanding between Germany and the United States after World War II. These people included Jack McCloy, who was the first High Commissioner in Germany, Christopher Emmett, who was a renowned journalist, and also my father, Eric Warburg. We're now 52 years old as an organization. We're a nonprofit, bipartisan organization that hosts and sponsored a whole variety of conferences, lecture series, and exchange programs transatlantically. I encourage you to check out our website, www.acg.org.usa, and we are now represented in 14 cities across the United States. Now I will introduce both of our speakers, and I will start with Professor Gesine Schwan, who has been president of the Europa-Universität Viadrina since 1999. She studied Roman languages, history, philosophy, and political science in Berlin and Freiburg-Breisgau in Germany, and has had several research stays in Poland. From 1971 to 1995, she was professor of political science at the Free University in Berlin, where she also served as dean from 1993 to 1995. She's been a member of the Commission for Fundamental Values of the Social Democratic Party in Germany, and since 1994, a member of the Board of Governors of the German Association of Political Science. Dr. Schwan has published extensively on normative and philosophic problems of theories of democracy and socialism, on the history of political ideas, on political psychology, and on current political issues, policy of the two now United Germany's détente and European unification. She is the recipient of the Bundesverdienstkreuz, which is the Federal Cross of Merit from Germany, and the Verdienstorden der Bundesrepublik Deutschland, which is the Medal of Merits of the Federal Republic of Germany. Professor Buchowski is a professor of anthropology at the University of Poznan in Poland and of comparative Central European studies at the Europa-Universität Viadrina in Frankfurt-Oder. He's currently a distinguished visiting professor for international affairs at Columbia University, where he's the first holder of the Polish Program Studies Chair. He has also lectured at the Universities of Kansas, the Humboldt University in Berlin, Germany, and Rutgers University. He's a fellow of the British Council, of the Fulbright Foundation, the Kosciuszko Foundation, and the Alexander von Humboldt Foundation, and has worked as a research fellow at the Centre Marc Bloch in Berlin, as well as the CNRS in Paris. His scientific interest is in modes of thought and systems of beliefs, as well as in Central European social and cultural transformations. He has published several books, among them most recently in English, Reluctant Capitalists, The Rational Other, Rethinking Transformation, and he is also the co-editor of Poland Beyond Communism and the Making of the Other in Central Europe. He's currently working on issues related to the encounter of the free market and democracy with the realities of post-socialist Poland. Welcome to you both, and maybe Professor Schwan, you will start first with your comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your extended and very kind and warm introduction. Well, this is challenges of European integration marks a period of transition, which reminds me experience I had in Washington about 25 years ago, I would say. This was the period of transition between Carter and Reagan, and I was a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars in Washington, and the old and late Macmillan came for a presentation, for a lecture. He was at that time around 82, 83 years old. He was on his stick, and he started his lecture saying, well, you know, once upon a time there was the situation in paradise. You remember maybe there was Eve who tempted Adam to eat the apple, and he ate the apple, and the things went wrong, and God sent them out of paradise, and they stood at the exit of paradise and watched the world, and then Adam said, well, Eve, we are now entering a period of transition. And this is a transition you can, yeah, always a transition. So the subtitle of what you wanted me to talk about is Views from Old and New Europe. And this reminds, of course, the famous saying of Rumsfeld. You all know Europe is a very heterogeneous continent. We have had lots of crises. We have always been questioned if the European Union will really survive these crises. Until now, it has survived the crises. The diversities of that continent are those of historical legacies, of collective memories, of different social and mental attitudes, and, of course, also of different political cultures. And that also shows you a little bit that I would like to focus on this dimension of diversities, first of all, because this is more the field I have been working on, but also because I think that the various interest conflicts, the special interest conflicts of economics, or also now the conflict on the Constitution, has to be embedded in problems of longer-lasting mentalities and longer-lasting historical legacies. When Rumsfeld spoke about the old and the new Europe, of course, it's now always laughed about, but I mean, the suggestion probably was that the new adherents were more on the new side in the kind of opposition between the United States and old Europe. So they were really the daring and the open and the ready to experiment being countries, whereas the present members of the European Union are already a little bit tired, have no new ideas, no imagination, etc. Maybe there's something with it, but what I will do now is not that much take the position of an old Europe country, but try to find out what are the cleavages, what are the main challenges, the main differences between the countries, and try also to present the views of Germany and Poland as I see it, and then go on and ask if we will have, can we really, in spite of these divergences and these problems, can we really come together? Can we? Do we share enough? Do we want to act in common? Are we only, or will we only be a political union, or will we, an economic union, or will we really become a political union? Are we more afraid of each other, or do we want really to come together and act together? So I will start with the main challenges and cleavages and differences. You all know, of course, that from the 17th century on, the idea of a social contract always had to secure freedom and security. This is the bottom line of all kinds of Hobbes and Locke and so on, social contracts models. And if the European Union wants to become a union, it has also to have a kind of contract. And I remember the Polish philosopher Leszek Kołakowski, when he was in Berlin and attended the Congress of Philosophy at a technical university. He then said, after breakdown of communism, now as communism has broken down and in a way freedom is guaranteed, the main point will be security. So what I will start with is the problems, the challenges, the cleavages in security perceptions of the two countries, but of different countries of Europe. And I could start with saying that there has been a recent survey ordered by the European Commission, and the data stem from, I think, 2001 or 2, which says that all over the 25 countries, the old one and the new ones, there is a general feeling of insecurity, a strong insecurity, which is not primarily caused by the neighbors, but by the general present movement of globalization, of cutting back social security, etc. So this is something they are sharing, but of course sharing insecurity feelings does not mean that they put them really together. Anyhow, this also stresses that security is an important issue. And so I would like now to go through some points of security concepts, security perceptions, starting by the traditional national security feelings, because although a modern term of security would include much other things and much more things than the traditional national threat horizons or threat theaters, they are still very deeply rooted in our collective memories, and therefore I think I should briefly name them. So starting with Germany and France, because I thought I should not only speak about Poland and Germany, starting with Germany and France, it has been very often said that their overcoming the so-called hereditary hostility or is a core point for the European Union, and therefore when in 2003 the anniversary of the Élysée contract was being celebrated, given the fact that the relationship between France and Germany had not been that wonderful the time before. We do forget that now, but I mean, we were very often afraid if we could really come together and Schröder and Chirac did not have a real deeply going friendship. So given that fact, everybody was first rather happy, and I mean, everybody interested in the European Union in Germany and in France was rather happy that there was such a deeply going in understanding. And then suddenly, all of a sudden, we discovered that it could be perceived differently. But even if it was perceived differently, one can say that the German-French cooperation during a large number of years has, to that date, neutralized the long-lasting problem of vice versa security threat, or more security threats through Germany than the other way around. By the way, if one goes now through the security perception, the old problem of, in a way, moderating Germany, the big Germany, comes up again, and this might be one of the reasons why we are again a little bit in trouble. Anyhow, I would say the first problem was that France, of course, always was a little bit distanced to a bigger role of Germany. We know that from, in spite of the German-French friendship, it was always a little distance to that, to a new role, and it was also kind of distrusting a new role Germany could have towards the Central and Eastern European countries, because the relations are, from a geographical point of view, closer, but they were also closer, had become much closer during the time. And after 89, France did not really show intense interest, for instance, in Poland or in other Central and Eastern European countries. This is one of the points why Poles are very often deceived by France. And this is, again, something which makes a problem for Poles now with the very close friendship between Germany and France. I remember an open letter Adam Michnik has written to Le Monde, where he very clearly complains about the disinterest of France towards Poland, in spite of the so-called long-lasting historical friendship between both countries. So this is one of the legacies where one security perception is tied to the other, and so it is kind of a play of balls, where you have always be careful that if you move one ball, you don't hurt the other one. The second, of course, is the security perception of Germany and of Poland. Poland has a traditional problem of two neighbors which have not been always very kind with that country, to say the least. So both countries, Russia and Prussia, have been experienced as occupying countries or as threatening countries. Germany has done what you all know during the Third Reich. So the main problem for Poland is to get security in that new Europe, and it cannot be blind towards the old historical legacy, which has a consequence that Poland very strongly relies on the Anglo-Saxon, especially the American nation, for security reasons. Poland was much more eager to join NATO than the European Union for that reason too. And as NATO has now become a little bit less important with the recent developments, it is rather understandable that Poland anyhow wants to be close to the United States. And by the way, also Germans have always argued that the presence of the United States in Europe is important in order to counterbalance Germany in a way and keep the others more secure, keep them more balanced and more secure, so that they would not have to be afraid of Germany. And this, of course, has important consequence also for the conception of the role of Europe as an actor in the international and on the global scene. Because if you take two types of first of all, one could, of course, also have the intention that Europe should stay with an economic union and not become a global political actor. I have heard such propositions also from important parts of the Polish government. I remember that last May when I took part in a Warsaw conference, and there were these propositions just, we want to remain rather independent concerning the political scene, and we want, of course, to be close together on the economic field. And then these are sharp discrepancies, because if others want the European Union to be a political actor, there starts to be a conflict. The next one could be, even if both agree that Europe should be a political actor, what would be the relationship towards the United States? What would be the transatlantic relationships? Germany tends to say, well, there should also be a kind of certain independence. It should not. There should be a light, of course, but Europe should not be tied once forever to any action the United States are doing, whereas Poland doesn't want to have any idea of competition or of antagonism or of balance of power whatsoever. And this is very well understandable if you take into account the ideas of the security perception. Next point is the relationship to Russia. I said already that Poland, of course, has always had a number of problems with Russia, not only with Germany. And I sometimes had the impression that after 89, but maybe you just correct me, after 89, Russia was not perceived anymore as a real present threat, but nevertheless, it was an unbeloved neighbor, sometimes less beloved than Germany, as far as I see it, and because, of course, also the traces or the remainings of the communist period were much more alive and much more vivid in their memories. So, but both Germany and Poland would agree that Russia could not become, of course, a member of the European Union, not because of cultural reasons. The whole story, if Dostoevsky is a European author or not, is not really important in that, but it's simply one has to make the difference between the political community in that sense and the cultural one, and that Russia would be much too big a member of the European Union. I think they all agree. But there is, as far as I see it, also a kind of reservation from the Polish side if there are too close cooperations, communications between Germany and Russia. And these are the old traditional problems of Poland between Russia and Germany. One problem concerning the security perception is that until now there hasn't been, as far as I see, a really thoroughgoing discussion on common European security perceptions. This is still lacking. A common perceptions or threat perceptions, security or threat perceptions, be it on terror, be it on climate, environment, energy, economy, corruption, whatsoever, these more modern and transnational origins of insecurity and threats. Myself, I'm moderating a Polish-German group called Polish-German Forum. Ambassador Reiter is the Polish head of that group, and we have talked the first time after a long period of non-common session. 2 years ago, we have had a common session in Warsaw, and then we already talked a little bit security issues, but it was completely different from last year, because we didn't have the conflict on Iraq, we didn't have all these conflicts. So it was more or less a theoretical discussion. And also, Poland was not obliged at that time to have any prominent profile position in the international role. It has now entered the international scene. And of course, if that might not be too disturbing to say, has also some experiences before. I mean, there you can have made some experience and you might make other experiences. And I could imagine that the Iraq war also is a kind of learning occasion for the roles we have to play in the international scene. So what I think, for instance, with our next meeting with the German-Polish Forum, we should absolutely again talk security issues together in order to find common, maybe first in order to understand the reciprocal views of security. And there is, of course, one problem that there is a very fundamental asymmetry, I will speak about that a little later again, between Poland and Germany concerning knowledge and interest. And also, there is a lack of knowledge, probably mainly on German side, on the German side, but partly maybe also on the Polish side, about the plurality of opinions, for instance, concerning the Iraq war. In Germany, nobody really took into account that there had been a discussion in Poland, too, and that Pospolita and Trybuna Ludu and Życie Warszawy, they had controversial points on that. Normal Mazowiecki, I remember a Mazowiecki interview, in one side interview in Gazeta Wyborcza, and I tried, by the way, to have it transferred to a German journal, Die Zeit or Der Tagesspiegel, and I didn't succeed in doing so. I was very unhappy about that, because that would have have been very interesting to see that long interview, because it was very close to reflections which were dealt with in Germany. So more knowledge about that would be very important. Second problem of perception is, of course, it's very close to security, the problems of regional hegemony. I mean, the hegemony problem is also one in the transatlantic discourse, but it is one of inner European discourse. And one can say, and this has been found out for all the Eastern countries, that they perceive themselves, all the adherent Eastern, Central Eastern European countries, perceive themselves, although to a different degree, as a kind of periphery to the center of the European Union. The EU has, in a way, replaced the Soviet Union in setting the standards and the rules. I make a difference, of course, between the EU and the Soviet Union, but in a way they wanted to adhere to the European Union, but then also they had to accept the rules. It was not really a question of negotiation. So, of course, there comes up a problem of hegemony and also of perception of periphery. And at the core, as far as I see it, is the question of self-esteem and recognition. And this, of course, is the older I grow, the more I see that this is mainly the core of any inner human conflict or social conflict. Self-esteem, it's not that much material. It's self-esteem and recognition. And so the problem of German-French cooperation, as I see it, it's threatens to a certain extent the Polish perception of their role, of her role in the European Union and her self-esteem and recognition. There is a lack of reciprocity on both sides. The EU and the newcomers are not yet on the same level. And on the other hand, it is, of course, also difficult for the European Union to deal with it, because the European Union cannot give up her inner rules of cooperation just to renegotiate the whole thing anew would be a very complicated thing for the European Union. So to a certain extent, there is no other way out than that the newcomers would accept the rules of the older. But this is psychologically, I think, a problem. The rules are, for instance, now important in the Constitution. You all know that the non-acceptance of the double majority rule in the Constitution was the main point why the Constitution was not voted. And I do not like very much the tendency that many in Germany say, well, it's only because of the Poles. Of course, and then the Poles say, it's not only because of us, but the other could have also reacted differently. And if you watch the conflict in an abstract way, you would ask yourself, well, why not that double majority? It's not that silly. But if you see the context between domestic politics and international relations, you very easily recognize that the argument in Poland for the referendum was, by the way, not that much Nizza, but was in general that Poland would not get lost, that the national self-determination would not get lost, that it would have an important position in the European Union, and that it would get win from the economic side. So they had to convince the Polish public to vote in the referendum, because you know that they had to have a 50% turnout in order to have the agreement realized. And I remember that all my friends in Poland were very anxious if these 50% would really come out. So they promised a lot in order to get the Polish public. And this, of course, makes it difficult then to Kind again to withdraw, seemingly withdraw from positions, although only after 2008, from positions one thought one has gained. There was an interview of President Kwasniewski in Der Spiegel where he very clearly says that he is optimistic that we will find solution, but that we have to get in a certain distance from the election and referendum campaigns. And that's the point, main point is trust. And this is for me a side of self-esteem and recognition, the next important category, the category of trust. So I think we will need a certain time to get a little bit distant from the election and referendum campaigns. And it's only if Germany succeeds and Germany and France succeed in proving that they do not want to be the new hegemony, and if the newcomers also succeed in showing that they are interested in a political union and not only an economic union, that we will find sufficient common ground. What have we to do? We have to do trust building. We have to be transparent in our decisions. We have to have a common security analysis with all the European countries and try to find out the real, the more adequate and the more present threats in order to get a little bit away from the historical perspectives. We should find out a setting, a perspective for Europe as an actor in a global setting. Should build European institutions. Education, of course, is very important. The most important resource, I think, to come together and then really to keep together is trust. It requires transparency and fairness and, of course, the willingness to learn. And I have a sentence I like very much, is a definition of power. Karl Deutsch, the former Harvard political scientist, gave for the term of power, he said, power is the possibility not to learn. So I think we have not yet that much power. We should learn and we can learn, and you will teach us how we would learn, right?
Well, the structure of my talk is quite simple. I start with a kind of review of basic fears that are present in Central and Eastern Europe, in post-socialist countries that are now accessing the EU, and I will divide them into economic, political, and cultural. And my argument is that these economic, political arguments, which were discussed by Professor Schwan, that these can be somehow reduced, in a sense, to these cultural problems. That is, and I understand, as an anthropologist, I understand culture in a wide sense. So, let's start with this economic challenge. I mean, what is accession? 75 million more in the European Union. 20. So the population will grow to by 20%, but the GDP will grow of the EU will grow only by 5%. This is a new territory which amounts to the territory of Texas, more or less, but it will make the EU a major economic power in the world, equal to the United States. Now it's a few percent behind the United States. And these economic fears or this economic problems Eastern Europeans see are, I would say, at least three. First, the structural fund distribution, that is, people are concerned that, you know, Europe now wants to invent new system of structural funds distribution that will somehow de-emphasize the poverty of these new regions and will redirect some money to old poor regions in the so-called old Europe. The other concern, economic concern, is that, you know, Europe now stresses its investment in high tech, And this means that most streams of money will be directed to old Europe, because Eastern Europe is more interested in the development of infrastructure. And last but not least, common agricultural policy, and it was one of the major bones of contention between the old and new Europe, especially Poland, that, you know, subsidies to farm production and to farmers are going to be kept at the level, initially at the level between one-third and one-and-a-half of the level of farmers, which would lead to the, will lead to the economic collapse of the whole sector of economy. Political challenges. European Constitution and all these discussions about Nice Treaty and the new prospect, I think that problem of trust was definitely involved in it. Transatlantic relations, the problem of security. I think you have exploited it very good and enough that, you know, most Eastern European countries, or I should rather say Central European countries, and paradoxically Central Europe is at the periphery of Europe, but these Central European countries are really have some fears against German French alliance, and also at the moment when Putin, Chirac, and Schroeder met in St. Petersburg, this was, you know, a kind of memory. Déjà vu. Yeah, déjà vu that scared many politicians, and not only politicians, but also populations. And therefore, Eastern European politicians, they strongly have to support the United States because they have an interest of American presence in Europe, and therefore they were willingly also enticed to support the American intervention or American war in Iraq. Now there is, in fact, a free flow of capital, but there is not going to be immediately, at least, a free flow of workforce. And you know, these are these political decisions are determined by internal political situation and opinions in particular states. If you look at the researchers and reports on this topic, these are, you know, some demons that are evoked because I can only cite the most recent research on this. There is only a draft of this research that, well, most probably, only 1% of the workforce is eager to migrate to Western Europe from Central Europe, and it comprises 120,000 people. And old Europe accepts every year 1.5 million immigrants from all over the world. So it's in a sense a drop in a sea, in fact, and it's an imagined, I would say, fear. And also one point more, you know, that being at the east flank of the new European Union, of course, these states are interested in a very good relations. At the same time, they want to be in the European Union, but at the same time, they would like to have a very good relations with eastern countries, especially Ukraine, but also with Russia, Belarus, and that's it. You know, I think that in all these political issues and economic issues, the issue of security, trust, hegemony is involved. But the issue of hegemony, which was mentioned by Professor Schwan, is especially present in something which I call a cultural domain or stereotypes. You may call it myth, and I call it personally myth, or the way people think about themselves in the whole Europe, and especially how they do think about themselves, you know, how Easterners, let's say, and Westerners think about themselves in Europe today. And in order to prove it, I would like you to travel in time and space, and I give you some example from Hawaii, which is, after all, America. In 1779, Captain James Cook navigated to Kealakekua Bay in Hawaii. He was greeted by the natives, and after spending a blissful time on the island, he and his crew sailed off in peace. Unfortunately, the ship's mast was damaged, and they quickly returned to repair it. This time, the former hospitality of the natives turned to hostility, and during a skirmish that broke out after sailors set foot on the island again, Captain Cook was killed. The Hawaiians subsequently paid sacred homage to Cook's corpse and returned it to the English. The radical change in mind was not merely caprice. Martian Salins, an anthropologist, interpreted these events as the realization of a myth. When Cook arrived, the Hawaiians were holding an annual ritual for the god Lono, who they believed would arrive on a ship. This coincidence led them to treat him like a god. However, the god was to leave the island after a short time, which Cook did, and not come back until next year. The immediate return Cook went against the script, and he had to be killed by those in power because it shattered not only the mythical structure, but also undermined the social hierarchy and the mythology it legitimized. And then my argument is that, you know, that this kind of myth, this what we have in our heads everywhere in the world, not only in Europe, is a charter for action. This actually is something that somehow motivates us for certain behaviors. A more closer example, I mean, more closer, especially for us, how Poland joined the European Union. If you look at the opinion polls about profits of joining the European Union, 4 out of 10 people say that it will be profitable for Poland. In the meantime, or in the referendum, almost eight out of 10 voted for joining the EU. And of course, there are many other arguments that why people that did vote. But I think that they voted also because they think that the place of Poland is in Europe. So they acted, and there is a myth that we are a European nation. We have this. We were a bulwark of Christianity. We are, a spearhead of Occident in Orient, and the things like this. So you know, the complex of this myth caused that many people voted because they were simply thinking, well, the EU is Europe, and we are a European nation. So. Myth helped somehow politicians because all these economic and political arguments, were not actually accepted by the majority of people. But that would mean that almost four out of 10 people voted against their reason because their rational reason told them, well, we shouldn't join this EU because it's not profitable for us. Nobody does it when thinks rationally, but we all. I think mythically, and I think that it also translates, to the European relations. So the first challenge now, after May 1st, we will have instead of May parade, we will have a Union parade this year. This will be first challenge is the subtitle of this session. I mean, the same division into old and new Europe. I mean, if you think historically or geographically, this is Europe. I mean, large parts of Russia is also Europe, but nobody thinks about Russia as Europe. Russia is Russia, or Poland is somewhere in. And I attended a conference or a session at Columbia quite recently, and somebody, said, well, Europe is now expanding. No, Europe is not expanding. The European Union is expanding. And if we can somehow break this centuries-old bifurcation of Europe into East and West, or old and new, then it will be the first step in the construction of new European Union, which will overcome also the issues, of trust and hegemony and the things like this. Well, in order to illustrate it, I will make only one citation from Jean Baudrillard. I don't have, of course, to introduce him. Collapsing regime, when he was commenting on Eastern European countries, he said something like this, wrote something like this. Collapsing regime exported its own economic and political suicide. From this point on, the barrier separating hell from heaven is liquidated. And in this case, of course, the liquefaction is general, and hell always submerges heaven. And of course, the hell is the east and the heaven is the west. The process is dangerous, he continues. The west is discovering the Eastern Bloc countries weak and drained, as once it discovered the survivors of the concentration camps. The danger is to feed them too quickly. Since this kills them, they live in another space, shattered by catastrophe. They will never come back into ours. The victory of the West is unlike the pressurizing of the West in the void of communism, in the void of history. So, you know, if you have this kind of image, I think, that, you know, it is hell and heaven, and that now there is a danger, there is a, you know, ambiguous state, transition, and there is a danger that the West will be somehow spoiled by this East, then, you know, you cannot build a trust. And if politicians think in the same way, and then also the population think about themselves in a similar way, then we are in trouble. And how this, what Jean Baudrillard, in very, very subtle philosophical narration, expressed, how it translates into some political opinions. Keith Grabe, once one of the celebrated experts on the European integration, once said about Poland, but I think she had in mind that almost everybody in Central Europe, Poland can become a nightmare of Europe if it's going to have Greek transparency of bureaucracy, Italian offices efficiency, Spanish grandiose attitude to structural funds, French stance toward agricultural policy, and British loyalty to the European idea. Well, funny as it is, I think that, you know, it shows some fears against Poland and other countries, but especially Poland. Poland is a half of the accession, is a half of the population and territory of the accessing countries. But it's also, you know, embedded in images or some myth about other nations. Italians are this, French are this, Brits are this. But there are, you know, different opinions and different people in different countries, as Professor Schwann said. I mean, there are, you know, dissent opinions, and there are, you know, politicians and media say something, and people also have different opinions. Also on the Polish stance, for example, in the negotiations over European constitution. There were letters of protest, yeah. You know, and the things like this. So what I think is that, you know, this national myth, or myth about stereotypes about nationalities and East and West, this is something that has to be definitely overcome in the near future. How this also translates into political practice, if you think about what François Mitterrand said about the Eastern European countries, you know, that they should rather sit in silence. And they had this opportunity and they didn't do it. I mean, it was a typical paternalistic attitude that he somehow spontaneously expressed at some moment. I mean, there was a conflict over war in Iraq, and there was a letter of some Western European countries, old Europe, Spain, for example, and Britain, of course, is in this coalition. But who was bashed? They don't work on only one way. There are also myths on the other side. I mean, this is the, you know, this kind of a mutual wall building, in a sense, by the creation of all these stereotypes. In order to do this, I will just make another citation from a Polish minister of culture from 1990s, mid-1990s, let's say, and member of the Polish Peasant Party, so you could imagine that he has some ideas, said something like this, official speech. Freedom, peace, and welfare have not been given to us forever. Today, our motherland needs us again. The sale of land for nothing and without permission to foreigners. Improper privatization. Permanent attacks against the basis of our national culture. And its defenders through foreign domination of the Polish language press. Now this is a kind of an anti-Semitic, in fact, threat in it. All these factors undermine the vital interests of our nation. This also breaks a fundamental rule of European unification, the principle of partnership and the equality of opportunities. What elements you have in it? I mean, there is an element of soil, of national material, and blood and soil we have. This is our blood. This is our blood that's soaked in the soil. Therefore, this is our territory, and we are not going to sell it to foreigners, especially Germans, who were just chased away from here, from this historic Slavic land. The same applies to industry and the threats of globalization that, you know, now, let's say 80% of banks are in foreign hands, and we don't have any national bank, and so on. So, you know, and also hostile conspiracy is in it. And, of course, the issue of national culture and tradition, but also of inequality. So, you know, this what you have said about self-esteem and recognition. If you, you know, treat the people, I'm not bashing François Mitterrand tonight, but if you treat them in the way as he expressed it, then they really try to defend them and they say, well, why we should, you know, join the union of people who treat us in this way? We rather stay alone. And this is what many people actually say. So, you know, what's common in this is, you know, and what's the conclusion, in a sense, from this? You know, in all these issues, there is a national, I mean, what from this last citation, what you can find there, there are some nationalist elements, particularist elements. And if Europe wants to unite, really unite and function as the United States, for example, functions, it has to go beyond these particularist and nationalist elements, and you know, and it has to overcome this negative, in a sense, myth, and build some new mythology, European mythology, that will be more powerful than these particularist mythologies about national tradition and so on. That doesn't mean that we have to, you know, to forget about these national issues and about diversity and so on. It's not about it. It's about solidarity that is more pan-European than particularistic. And at the moment, this myth, because it's another myth, all we you know, our rational choices are always embedded in these, you know, cultural schemes, that at this moment European public, not only politicians, not only scholars, intellectuals, but also and journalists, but also European population, if all of them can somehow build this new consciousness and this new mythology, then I think Europe will function. And therefore I think that build up of this cultural unity, in a sense, of Europe, or this unity built in these convictions, is the biggest challenge that will somehow, you know, help to build trust, overcome hegemony, and at the same time will make the Europe working as a peaceful continent. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a panel discussion on The Challenges of European Integration, Views from Old and New Europe, presented by Boston University's Institute for Human Science and the American Council on Germany in cooperation with the Consul General of the Federal Republic of Germany. Our speakers tonight were Gesine Schwan, president of the European University Viadrina in Frankfurt, and Professor Michael Bukowski, a distinguished visiting professor for international affairs at Columbia University, where he is the first holder of the Polish Program Studies Chair. Our panelists were introduced by Marie Warburg, director of the American Council on Germany. For a cassette or CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and John Perotti, with help from Michael Garth. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.